welcome to Book Talk. I'm your host, Danny Scott, for a wide-ranging chat about The Humans by Matt Haig. In Haig's latest book for adults, Professor Andrew Martin's solving of the Riemann hypothesis has set off a warning light many light years from Earth on planet Vonadoria. Fearing what warmongering, greedy humans will do with this mathematical leap forward, the Vonadorians kidnap Martin and replace him with their very own man who fell to Earth, an assassin masked in the professor's body, tasked with destroying all evidence of his discovery, including his wife Isabel and son Gulliver. Only this alien assassin becomes more human by trying to act like one and strays from his original mission. Joining me in the Book Talk studio to discuss the meanings, merits, and what reading The Humans felt like as a human are Lindsay Rogers, the whip-smart voice behind our agony aunt Miss Wright and key part of our writer development and bookbug teams, and Leith librarian, literature, learning, and reading for enjoyment advocate Colm Linnane. Our alien becomes more human in large part due to the poetry of Emily Dickinson, who once wrote, "If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain." Judging by the overwhelmingly positive reviews and the comments we've received on Twitter, this book has done more than that. But what did it do for you?
It's interesting you say how well reviewed it is, because I came to this book quite excited. I'd heard a lot of good things. I've seen a lot of very positive reviews. I've seen loads of people on Twitter gushing about it. The early part of reading the book was this kind of rising panic that maybe I was reading this wrong, or that perhaps there was something wrong with me as a reader. I found it hard going. In a way, there's kind of nothing necessarily wrong with the book. It's interesting you mention Emily Dickinson. She does kind of occasionally rise up within the book, and her kind of strange, curt tones are kind of a really sharp contrast to a lot of telling. The book tends to tell you about an awful lot of things, and it tells you in a very urgent, very, very earnest way. I didn't feel there was a huge amount of mystery, and maybe my expectations were unrealistic, or potentially I'm just looking for something else in a book like this. Although, you know, Haig, as he says himself throughout the book, there's only one genre of books, and that's books. And I agree with him in that. But definitely I found parts of this book left me very cold.
Which parts were there specifically?
The beginning is, and you know, this is the kind of setting, the scene is that this alien comes to Earth to kill Anthony Martin, who is a professor who has solved the Riemann hypothesis. For an alien, he seems to talk remarkably like a university professor. He just sounds way too human. You know, he comes from a hyper-rational society, one where the only religion is mathematics, that there's no conflict, that reason rules everything. But he really does come across as a kind of a living, breathing Richard Dawkins Twitter account kind of come to life.
Lindsay, the quote number 86 from the list of 97 ways to live your life that Matt Haig includes later on in the book says, "To like something is to insult it. Love it or hate it, be passionate." So be passionate. How would you sell this book to someone?
I have to say, I think similarly, I came to the book with completely different expectations from what we actually got in it. It is very readable, especially the second half of the book, when you get to the sort of twist and he decides to stay human.
I mean, Haig admits it's more of him in this book than any of his other ones, and he hails from Sheffield, just like Professor Andrew Martin hails from Sheffield. This book very much felt like the world through Matt Haig's eyes, didn't it?
He refers to that in the preface. Why would you torture yourself by writing a semi-autobiographical novel? And he's disparaging about it. And again, I found myself playing this kind of cat and mouse game with him, constantly going, is this my problem as a reader or your problem as an author? And I always came up against this, oh, actually, it's probably my problem as a reader. So now, is that me failing or not having the courage as somebody who's reading to just say, I don't like it?
I think that's fine. I think Matt Haig would encourage that too. I think he'd probably subscribe to the belief that a book changes with every reader that reads it. It's a different book for everyone. There was that slightly mawkish feel to it and sentimentality to it, and a lot of aphorisms that you could put on a poster.
Absolutely.
I felt like I was reading a series of Facebook memes. It's a bit of a tried and tested plot. I mean, we've seen it in Mork and Mindy. We've seen it in The Man Who Fell to Earth with David Bowie and the book that was based on. We've seen it in Wings of Desire and The Awful City of Angels that was based on, and of course in Spock. In fact, I have a quick test for you guys. Who said, is it Spock or Professor Andrew Martin that said, "It is curious how often humans manage to obtain that which they do not want"?
Spock.
Yep, he's right. But jesting aside, what does Matt Haig bring to this tried and tested plot? Because he's bringing a lot of himself.
That's actually what he brings to it, is that he is very successful in breaking something which is a sci-fi trope out of a sci-fi silo, if you like. It's very much of its time. And this alien's explaining the anxieties of a narrow band of the humans on this planet. He does go into that, but I do think that there are these little things that bubble up every once in a while. He says early in the book, the human alphabet only has 26 letters, and you're kind of going, you're supposed to be a super intelligent alien that has an awareness of languages and different modes of communication, maths, you know, all of this kind of thing. But occasionally, the naivety and the kind of engaging voice that he's trying slips, and you see the author there kind of in the room a little bit. Because sometimes he'll go into his telling you about things and explaining phenomena mode. It's actually when the author or the alien or both become active within those scenes. There's a brilliant, brilliant scene where he kind of hacks his son's social media. And it is genuinely fantastic. It's a beautiful piece of wish fulfillment, total fantasy. You know, everybody will have been there, the ability to actually turn on somebody who abuses you, particularly an anonymous person or somebody who's bullying you online. It's a really, really great little piece. And then you're back into the alien explaining human phenomena. And I think, as you were saying, he is a very, very talented writer, but the way this book is written, he's very quotable, and it's almost, he's very prolific on Twitter. And the book, the list at the end, you know, is Twitter ready? You just wonder whether a novel is the right format for the story that he's telling. Are there different ways of telling the story? And this is kind of, you know, feeds into the kind of broader anxiety about, oh, is the novel dead, or where does the novel need to go from here? I don't think this necessarily brings a huge amount that's new. As you say, it's quite a conventional story. It's been done a number of ways. I think he's a very talented writer. But stylistically, and again, this is personally, it didn't do much for me. I think if you're looking at kind of mental breakdown, that kind of an otherworldly person disrupting the lives of humans around them. Look at Ali Smith's There But For the Grace Of. I couldn't actually get that book out of my head. That book is plotted an awful lot more haphazardly. It's probably, it wasn't as well reviewed, and its plot limitations were identified as being, but the style in that book and the way that she writes from the varying different characters, it really stays with you. And there's something beautiful and luminous about the way that she writes. And I think that Haig is talented, but he doesn't have that verve, that really astonishing style that really kind of blows you away, and that it never leaves you.
Another book I'd throw into that mix would be Under the Skin by Michelle Faber. I think we covered it in a recent podcast, and there's a lot in there about seeing human life through alien eyes. And I feel like I learned a lot more about the human condition through that, despite its grisliness and the different motives of the characters. And actually, speaking of motives of characters, what did you make of the supporting cast? Sci-fi book critic Niall Alexander at Nihilalot on Twitter wishes that Matt Haig had invested more meaningfully in a number of the narrative's more contrived characters. How did you experience the supporting cast, Lindsay?
Yeah, I would have to agree that I didn't really feel the supporting cast were particularly well developed. Particularly, Gulliver felt like a walking sort of teenage cliche, really. I mean, it kind of goes back to something we mentioned earlier, but even the very first time he meets Gulliver, he has all these descriptions about, oh, you know, shrugging is part of teenagers' language or whatever it was. And that's the first time he's ever met a teenager. It just, how do you interpret that? How do you know that? So that immediately kind of just felt really flat to me. And with Isabel as well, I quite liked the kind of little glimpse we had. I mean, it was obvious she was very unhappy. And I quite liked that moment where he found the novel that she'd written. But I think as well, even for Andrew, when we get descriptions of him, it's just always kind of reported by other people. It was just people constantly saying, oh, you were always home late, and you always did this, you always did that.
And nobody really seems to get suspicious.
No, which is really strange.
Completely different. And yes, he's had a mental breakdown, and maybe people are trying to be sensitive about it. I think one of the things that I think is particularly unsuccessful, and I think slightly distasteful, is that violent people kind of come into their orbit. So there's kind of yobbos in the pub, and there's a particularly violent scene in which the guy, his aggressor, it's somebody he's met in the mental hospital who has conveniently reported that she's attracted to violent men. And bingo, bango, here's the violent man. And the violent man, and four sentences later, he's battering the head off him. And it just kind of feels like there is this kind of slightly hectoring and disapproving tone. I think it's quite confused on violence. There are situations in which Andrew and Gulliver beat people up and it's seen as being okay. Maybe he's kind of trying to comment on the kind of addictiveness of violence. I think there's kind of a distaste of other people who aren't clever and sensitive and loving and nice. that I found, I was kind of like, what actually is going on here?
Yeah.
Because you have the violent guy who beats him up, you know, and his language is awful and he looks really hard. And you're just kind of like, hold on a second, where are we coming from here? That it's okay for Gulliver to stand up to his bullies.
Mm-hmm. There is a kind of fear of the working class. Is that maybe going too deep into this novel? But I mean, the prism of this novel is a very middle class prism.
It definitely is. We don't get any sort of, apart from the violent thug who turns up and has a bit of a fight and then disappears again.
The only time people who are different come in, they're threatening and menacing.
Yeah, the guy in the petrol station.
I just find the kind of whole thing, I did find that a very strange note for a book that is about loving other people, you know, that is about the need for love and understanding. I just think that it's particularly weak on what it's trying to say about violence. I think it's slightly judgmental on one point, but also it kind of wants to say, but there are justifiable reasons for using violence as well. It's like violence is part of the human condition in the same way that death is and disease is and mortality and all of the rest of these things that he's trying to explore.
Yeah, because there is that whole bit when Gulliver is sleepwalking and he attacks alien Andrew. And there's that little line where he says that every human has that violent instinct that's just kind of bubbling under the surface. Everyone is just kind of walking around suppressing that.
And the only people who are portrayed as using violence outside of both Andrew and Gulliver are the nasty people on the outside. And it is something definitely that kind of really jumped out at me and that I was kind of going, this feels very pat.
But I mean, this book is a very funny book. I laughed a lot, but there is a danger, and we have touched upon it, that this book starts to read like a self-help novel and culminates in this list. I was beginning to get to a stage where I wasn't sure how I felt about this book, and then that list arrived and I thought, oh my goodness, surely your observation should be arising through your character's interactions. You don't need to list them. It almost felt like Matt Haig had a bunch of observations that he wanted to get into the story but didn't have the space for, and he felt like he'd rammed it in there. I know you write, Lindsay. I mean, what did you feel about that section? Because it's a bit of a bold choice.
Yeah, I have to agree that it did feel slightly kind of shoehorned in a little bit. And interestingly, since the books came out, he ran that Twitter competition as well, where everyone could record themselves reading.
And you can watch it on YouTube, can't you?
Yeah. So there's a video of all of them being read out by different humans across the world. I think it would have worked slightly better in the context of the novel had more of the advice directly applied to Gulliver, because I got about halfway through the list and there was a reference to him and I remembered, oh, actually, yeah, he is writing this list for his son.
I think that it's kind of interesting that what you're saying about, you know, him having his Twitter competition of everybody reading kind of Vines or YouTube kind of the rules within it. And that is a kind of an intertextual thing that actually is quite interesting, you know, and that I'm kind of is interesting in
and
terms
Matt Haig
of
is brilliant at that.
He's very, very good at engaging with readers and engaging with an audience and how that back and forth is and interrogating and examine what the relationship between an author and a reader is. Mm. So I do think that stuff is interesting. I think the list is variable. I think there's some good stuff in there. Mm. There's some completely contradictory stuff. You know, again, like we're talking, he's saying, why would you torture yourself with a semi-autobiographical novel? And then he's advising Isabel to write a semi-autobiographical novel. There's lots of that kind of stuff going on. And obviously these types of lists, and when you're pouring your heart out to your son or somebody that you love, it's not going to totally make sense. And that's okay. I think we can kind of, I at that stage, I was kind of going to give him a pass on it. Mm-hmm. It was certainly the earlier stages that I found it more difficult to kind of engage with what the book was doing.
Right.
There are some absolute classics in there, though. It's not the technique, it's the method. It's not the words, it's the melody. I think that this book is about technique and words. It doesn't have that music that maybe Ali Smith or somebody like that has. But I do think it's a really fun book. It's very readable, and I think it should have a bigger audience.
And in a recent list that Matt Haig wrote for the Telegraph book section, he said that the writer is now as much of a commodity as a book. As you say, with the list that he's put in there and the way he's engaged his readership on YouTube, I mean, there's a lot to be admired with what he's trying to do here. And he has bared his soul quite a lot in this book, and I certainly enjoyed spending time in the head of Matt Haig and seeing the world as he sees it.
I mean, what I prefer about Matt Haig's writing is when he's writing as Matt Haig, and he writes very, very well about mental health, about depression. He's always at pains to say, this is my experience, and difficulty with mental health is a profoundly subjective experience. And he's very, very good on that.
Finally, guys, Haig says that The Humans could be compared to a fantasy TV show by David Attenborough, only with the subject matter being humans. So what does this book tell you about how to be a human?
Being a human is that constant trying to kind of work out what it is. And I think again, that was kind of one of the things that, you know, maybe it's, you mentioned kind of being cynical, but also it's kind of being anti-authoritarian. I don't like being told what to do and how to respond to things. This book does seem
I was getting told off for a lot of the
book, or kind of jockeyed around a bit, or for being a little bit cynical. But I think what the book does try to do is kind of how humans can only really live in the present. And I think that successful writing does have a sense of the future. It has a sense of the ticking clock and about the kind of that death is coming. Mm-hmm. I didn't really get a huge sense of that, even though he talks, people die, there isn't a huge amount of grief or remorse or analysis of that. When he becomes human, is there space for him to have, that effectively, I mean, he caused or may have killed people, or had certainly caused the death of one of his colleagues.
And he doesn't seem to show much remorse for that. And the
guy's dead and off we go.
And also he's been exposed to music, he's been exposed to films, he's been exposed to a lot of things, and he's become very human. But then he seems to have no compunction about going and sleeping with Maggie. It's almost like he gets led down the path.
That really jarred for me.
Yeah.
I didn't understand how he couldn't quite tune into what was happening in that moment and didn't have any kind of...
I don't know. I think the kind of, again, it's kind of that thing about, oh, right, for an alien, he sure is like a kind of a middle-aged straight man. That's the thing. His humanity is very consumptive. He consumes things. So he goes around and he tries peanut butter and he drinks white wine and he listens to music. And all he's really doing is kind of these very 20th century kind of consumptive experiences. He's not, and also he kind of says, you know, towards the end of the book, he's like, all of these things don't really matter.
The kind of basic message as well is there was that bit about self-preservation through caring, talking about the future in a sense of that's how you continue on and that's kind of part of your purpose here. Yeah, having that whole kind of comparison with the alien race who, you know, they don't sort of have the same emotional experience, and to appreciate the good things, the poetry and the happiness, you have to have the pain. And that came across relatively well. I think that's kind of what he's saying, that, you know, you have these kind of dark, painful moments, but you need to have them in order to appreciate
true beauty and love.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting thing as well about, you know, the fact that there really have only been about 150,000 generations of humans. And he does some very interesting chat about maths, about how ultimately each individual's
impossible.
The impossibility or the unlikeliness of how unlikely it is that individual people can possibly exist. I thought that was really nicely expressed. I'm not sure whether it holds. I'd like to talk to somebody who actually knows loads about kind of probabilities to kind of maybe work out the sums.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the novel, that moment was quite nice because that was really when he started to, his feelings or perception towards Isabel started to change. That was when he started to look at her in a different way. Yeah. So
Begins to fall in love with her. And absolutely. It did have kind of a lovely kind of moment. The other thing that really started jumping into my head, the other writer was Douglas Copeland. This feels like a very Douglas Copeland book. Again, it's kind of got these kind of weird, unlikely kind of situations. And again, it felt more earthbound, some of maybe Copeland's work. His kind of Girlfriend in a Coma, but there's Hey Nostradamus and those ones as well.
Yeah.
I think where he was writing in that kind of futuristic, what does it mean to be human? Mm-hmm. What will it mean to be human in the 21st century? And I think it can go alongside that, you know, in terms of really smart, very engaging, you know, modern fiction that the general reader can really enjoy, I think.
Yeah, I still can't help but feel that there's kind of two books fighting in one. And like we said earlier, I think the bits that leave most lasting impression are the bits that are coming from Matt's experience and his perspective, really emotional perspective. So I still kind of feel that I wish he'd stuck with a much more kind of straightforward concept of the whole mental breakdown. Another book that comes into my head is A Spot of Bother by Mark Haddon. He does a similar kind of, it's just, you know, reading a man slowly unraveling mentally, but it's just really beautifully done. And I feel if he'd kind of stuck with that initial inspiration and drive behind the story, I think it could have been more successful.
But I mean, that's the thing to be very, very clear about. I mean, I really do feel like a lot of my criticisms of the book are down to me as a reader and what I took from it.
And how I came to it as well, and what I expected versus what I got.
And sometimes it's kind of when you do come to a book that has been very highly thought of, maybe you can kind of just have your expectations can never quite match up with the book.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for on Water Planet 7081. But, fellow humans, our discussion of The Humans doesn't need to end here. Please tweet us your thoughts at Scottish BK Trust or start a discussion with us and other listeners in the comments section at scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk. Tune in again in a fortnight's time for our interview show packed with insight into a wide range of issues in authors' lives, and in a month's time when we'll be discussing the intriguingly titled The Sex Lives of Siamese Twins by Irvin Welsh. Until then, thanks to Lindsay, Colm, producer Colin Fraser of Culture Laser, and of course you, the listener. Nanu, nanu.